today. Before we start, I'd like to open by acknowledging the Gadigal and Ngurungai people of the Eora Nation, upon whose ancestral lands the university now stands. I pay my respect to their elders, both past and present, as the traditional owners and custodians of the land where we now welcome the Honourable Michael Kirby to speak. I'd now like to hand over to the Acting Dean of the Faculty of Law, Leslie Hitchens, to formally welcome the judge.
Thank you, colleagues. Judge, it's a great pleasure to welcome you here today. I don't need to say anything about, to give any background to introduce you in any way, because we know that you're so well known to us, both in your time as a member of the High Court and in your long judicial and public career, but also very much in your post-judicial career. You've maintained an incredible activism, both pursuing matters of justice, both nationally and internationally. And as well, I noticed on your website that you talk about your desire to speak directly and not simply through law reports. And it's wonderful that you are taking the opportunity to come to us today and to speak directly to us in this way. And I'm also very conscious of your energy that you have. Some people retired, in fact even me not retired, might think when I'm just back from an international trip that I might prefer just to go and have a cup of coffee and relax. But the judge has come here today having just flown back from Indonesia. And I know that last year I was participating in a conference at UNSW on the rule of law, and you introduced that conference as well, having just flown back from a long international trip, again pursuing matters of justice in the international arena. So it's a very great pleasure to have you here, and I think we're very interested by this provocative title about what's behind the purple curtain. So thank you again.
Thank you very much, Dean Hitchens, and thank you all for coming along today. I thought if I chose a slightly provocative title, it might get you in instead of going out and having coffee in the environs here. And I'm very proud of my links with UTS. I was made an honorary graduate of the university 2 years ago, and I thank Professor Jill McHugh, who's here today, who was Dean at that time, and it was a very special day. I brought my father along and my partner, and it was full of festivity and happiness. I've just returned from Indonesia, an hour and a half ago. And it is true, my partner's beginning to complain about all this energy. Where do I get the energy? But when I was in Indonesia, I was invited by the judges of the Supreme Court of Indonesia to go and see their building, which I'd never seen before, although I'd been to Jakarta a few times. And with the judge who was my host was a man who was in charge of the public relations and media relations of the Supreme Court of Indonesia. And lo and behold, he was a graduate of UTS. He was a master's graduate here, and he loved the university, and he loved his experience, and he loved Sydney. He kept talking about King's Cross, but I thought that was a bit too much information. I hope that through my meeting with him and putting the faculty in contact with him, we can make a good link, and a good link that way to the Supreme Court of Indonesia. As I told the people at the conference in Indonesia, really Indonesia is the hope of the Asia-Pacific region. I mean, it's amazing the developments that they have made in the last few years, both in the rule of law and in democracy, and the conference was actually about freedom of information, because Indonesia and Thailand are the only countries of Asia that have an FOI Act, And apparently the Thai Act is a bit of a dead letter, but in Indonesia it's a very, very active statute, and lots of applications made, and I was able to tell them about my virginal track record in the High Court of Australia in upholding rights of access to information, including a famous dissent which I wrote with Chief Justice Gleeson jointly in a case called McKinnon against the Treasury, which related to an application by Professor McKinnon, who was the head of the Press Council, to get access to documents from the Treasury during the Howard government, and it was rejected by the High Court 3-2, and a very bad day that was too. But it was a wonderful conference, so you can be proud. There's a person who's a member of your faculty and who is over there in a key position, and I told them I think they have things to teach us in the briefing and communication to the media, because we're pretty poor at that. And the High Court, though it has a stream of really interesting and important cases, really it gets very little coverage except on trivia and rubbish, and that's I think partly because the court hasn't yet found a way to communicate effectively with the media. Now, I want to talk today not about a substantive matter, before I go on, I should acknowledge my mentees. I have two mentees from the University of Technology, Sydney, who are assigned to me by the faculty, and they are sitting in this room, Michael Monk and James Chin. Stand up, my mentees. Come on, up you get. I want to say these guys are brilliant, they are extremely hardworking, and they are my slaves who do the work. So thank you both very much. I'm very proud that I am a mentor in what will be your glorious careers. This could be your opportunity too, to work as a slave for an ex-justice of the High Court. So think about it. Now, today is not a substantive topic. I'll come back and talk about a substantive topic, and I have a very good lecture that I could give you on statutory interpretation, which is really a very important subject. And it's a subject, interestingly enough, upon which the justices of the High Court never had a lot of differences about the basic rules. They sometimes got to a different end, but the basic rules that we have adopted in recent times makes for an interesting subject, and it's a key subject for every lawyer. You can't be a lawyer in practice if you don't know the latest on statutory interpretation. But what I want to talk about today is really something about what my life was like when I was a justice of the High Court, back in those glorious days when I was a justice of the court. What is it actually like to be there? And I think it's suitable to do this to a class at a law school, because when I was at the law school at Sydney University, which was the only law school in Sydney, New South Wales at the time, we were told, look to the right and look to the left, and one of you might end up a judge. Well, I looked to my right and there was Murray Gleeson, and I looked to my left and there was David Hodgson, and all of us became judges. So I think it's suitable that you should reflect upon the fact that one possible life course and stream for you to think about in the long term is a judicial post, and certainly it's as far as I found it, a wonderful and uplifting and honourable thing to do. And our profession and the common law system is very much built around the judges, and therefore they are a source of constant irritation when they write very long opinions. I'm not mentioning or thinking of anyone in particular. And when they when they give decisions which seem a little bit over the top or out of contact with reality. But the judges are pivotal to our common law system. So it's interesting to know what it's like as a justice of the High Court. Well, first of all, I arrived there. My partner drove me down to Canberra, and I arrived soon after I'd been invited to and accepted the post as a justice of the court. And I got down there on a Friday afternoon late. The building was empty. There was no one there. Everyone had gone home. And I was ushered up to level 9, which is where the justices' chambers are on the top of the building. And I couldn't, they let me into the chambers and I looked around, and it was a very beautiful room. It was Sir William Dean's room, because the slot I got was when Sir William Dean was appointed the Governor General. So he was going off to Yarralumla, and that left the slot in the High Court. And so I went into this room, which is, each of the chambers of the justices is decorated with different wood from different parts of Australia. And mine was blonde wood from Tasmania, and a particularly beautiful light coloured wood. And so I went towards the balcony. Every justice has a balcony, which in my case overlooked Old Parliament House and New Parliament House and the Brindabellas. There was a door onto the balcony, and I opened it and pushed it, and I couldn't get out. And ultimately I summoned somebody from downstairs in the security, and they came up and they said, "You've got to push properly." So he pushed strongly on the door, and all it showed was my weakness in not being able to push the door open. But everything is sort of heavy, strong, and rather beautiful, but not many people see it. I mean, it's a world apart. I found on the desk a cassette which was left there. In fact, there are a couple of them. One of them I put on the playing machine, and it had a horse race on it, which rather scandalised me because of my Protestant upbringing. But Sir William Dean was a very, very keen gambler, only in small amounts. But he used to have, when he missed the horse races, when he was down listening in the court, he was thinking of who's running in number 5 at Randwick today, and he'd get his secretary to record it. So there was this horse race on the thing. Naturally, I erased that straight away. I didn't want that. But another was a dictation of a judgment, obviously, and I heard this voice, and I didn't recognise the voice, but I also heard what it was about, and it was about a right of standing to sue, and by checking and listening further, I realised that it was the case of onus in the High Court, which is a very important case, in about 1984, I think, or 83. And this was the voice of Sir Keith Aiken, long since dead, dictating his reasons in Onus and Alcoa, which is a very important case about standing to sue. And naturally, I sent that straight off to the National Archives, because there it is. It was the original draft which he he was doing. And it made me realise that I was simply somebody who was passing through that room, and Sir Keith Aiken, who had been a very great advocate before the High Court, was there captured on the tape dictating his opinions, as many other tapes and memory sticks would record various opinions of mine and articles and book reviews and all the other things that you love to read. and which I would prepare over the years. I brought with me to the High Court the two associates I had from the Court of Appeal, and in accordance with my practice, I always advertised for associates because I wasn't very much in favour of the old boy network. The old boy network, and I mean the old boy network, still operates in some quarters in the law, and I didn't. I had a brilliant leaving certificate result. I was top of the state in history, top of the state in general mathematics, maximum pass, but I couldn't get articles of clerkship. And that taught me that sometimes in the law things are not always equal opportunity, so I was determined I would be equal opportunity. And I always had one male and one female associate, and I brought both of them from the Court of Appeal to the High Court. The female associate, Peggy Dwyer, is at the bar, and she does a lot of work in Aboriginal causes, and she's always been very strongly motivated in that respect. The male associate was Nick James, who became very famous because he got on a rollerboard, and he rolled down the ramps in the High Court. And what he didn't realise was everything is being recorded on film. Anyway, they worked, and my associates worked in the court, one of them in Canberra and one of them in Sydney, working on the work that the justices do. As you know, the judges of the High Court do really three tasks. They sit in constitutional writs, they sit in appeals, and they sit in practice matters and applications for special leave to appeal. You don't get into the High Court now as of right. You only get in if you get leave, special leave, to appeal to the court. And so that takes quite a lot of time, and you have to prepare for that. In the week where you're assigned to a special leave panel, you do that on a Friday, you hear the case on a Friday, and earlier in the week, the senior judge who is presiding, which increasingly towards the end was myself, will summon the other two justices to his or her chambers to talk about the cases and to give impressions as to whether they are suitable for a grant of special leave or not. So to prepare for that, I would go down to Canberra on a Sunday, and a huge bundle of application books were on my desk. They were that high. And they were the application books for the special leave hearings. And the application books had inside them the summaries of the argument being advanced by the applicant and the respondent. The applicant saying why they should get special leave, the respondent saying why not. Generally, that was about 5 or 6 pages. And so your job was to absorb the book, to read the decision of the court below, to read the submissions, and if you were sufficiently intrigued or that was relevant to do so, to go into the application book and read some of the evidence and get that into your mind. Quite a hard day. Doing special leaves is really hard work because you have to keep up to 12 cases in your brain, and you've got to make sure that you've been fair to the parties and you've got the points they're trying to make, because this is the end of the road. If they don't get special leave, it's all over. And therefore, the judges all take it very, very seriously. And by the Tuesday, they've all read it, and then they'll come together and have a cup of tea after court on the Tuesday in the chambers of the senior justice and talk about their impressions of the case. And then it's the job of the senior justice to decide whether they will sit 2 or 3. It has to be 2, but it can be 3. If it's an important matter, or if there are differences about whether special leave should be granted or not, then the senior judge will suggest that they all sit. But normally, two sit. And towards the end of my time in the High Court, because we were getting flooded with applications for special leave by refugee applicants, there was a big shift to dealing with matters on paper. And nowadays, most of the special leave applications are dealt with on paper by two justices. That puts extra duties on the justices to make sure they don't miss anything, because that's dealt with out of court and never gets into the court, and is never gets into an oral hearing in the court, but is dealt with by the court on the papers. Interestingly enough, very rare to have differences between the judges as to whether a case should get special leave. I mean, we often had differences about outcomes, but as to whether it was a case suitable for special leave, not very much difference, because you can sort of smell a case, you can smell a High Court case. That's not very helpful to tell law students as to what, or barristers for that matter, or solicitors, you know, well, will I get special leave? Well, it's a question, does it have the smell? It's not the vibes, it's the smell. And if you go through it, most of the justices will agree, well, this looks like a goer. And then, as you know, the barristers have 20 minutes to try and argue to get in. And I've often seen judges who are against granting leave or for granting it change their mind. I've done so myself because of the advocacy. That's a very stressful job for a barrister to try and get 20 minutes to try and persuade judges either to grant or not to grant special leave. It's sort of concentrated brilliance in a very short time. And it is very stressful for the advocates, but it's also quite stressful for the judge, because you know that people's hopes and fears and expectations and money and life and love and everything's hanging on this case, and you have the power to open the door or slam the door shut. So that's a lot of the work of a judge of the High Court. It sounds administrative and not so interesting, but it's very interesting, because all of the cases, if they've got so far, have got an arguable point to some degree, and therefore they're really quite interesting. The other two things that the justices do are to sit on the applications on the constitutional writs. The constitutional writs, as you know, they used to be called prerogative writs. Constitutional writs under Section 75 of the Constitution, that gives a party the direct access to the High Court. If it's an issue about an excess of power or failure to exercise power by an officer of the Commonwealth, you get on the escalator and you can go straight to the High Court. And that was one of the innovations in our Constitution. The court can send it somewhere else to have the facts tried, but it's a fast track of important constitutional cases or legal cases. So that's an important part of the work of the court. But the most important part are appeals. The appeals are the core of the work of the High Court of Australia. Again, you get the big appeal books. Often they're mountainous. The High Court hasn't moved to electronic appeal books. It deals with matters on the papers, and that means hard copy, and the judges have to churn through those with the written submissions, reading the written submissions. If the judge, when reading them, sees a point that doesn't seem to have been noticed or a point upon which the judge wants help, then there is discussion amongst the judges and a letter is sent off by the registrar of the court asking for further assistance. Then you get more submissions, and that's the written material. That's a big change from my days when I began as a young lawyer, because in those days there were no written submissions. Everything was oral. It was the great oral tradition of the English bar. Everything was done orally. I remember going up to the High Court as a junior with Mr. Marnie, QC, later Dennis Marnie, a judge of the Court of Appeal and president. He followed me as president of the Court of Appeal. And Marnie had written submissions, which he handed up. Chief Justice Barwick was sitting in the middle, and he said, "What's this?" And Justice Marnie said, "Oh, Your Honour, these are short submissions which have put more succinctly than I have been able to put the argument. We don't receive those things." And he said, "Well, I thought, Your Honour, that perhaps some of Your Honour's brethren might find it helpful, deference, grovel. And anyway, he ultimately got it up. One of the judges said, "Oh, yeah, I wouldn't mind having those." And so up it went, and he said to me as he walked away, "Michael, they will forget everything I have said to them, but they'll have my little document with the written submissions." And I think the realisation of that led to the growth of the system of written submissions, and you find that generally things are put more succinctly. The advocates have to sign them, so they take responsibility for them and can be criticised if they're not up to scratch. But that is now the core of the work, and it cuts down the time you have in court, because generally most cases are over in a day or even half a day, because the court can become a hot court of getting on top of the case and knowing what the issues are and being able to direct questions directly to the key issues in the case. So for the running of the court administers itself, and every first Monday of every month the justices meet in the big conference room of the court in Canberra, and they go through the budget of the court and the staff issues, the library needs, the needs of individual chambers, the leaking roof. Flat roofs are always a problem, and the roof in Canberra is a flat roof. So there are all the issues of the running of the court which take place and are discussed in those meetings, and the annual report of the court is settled, and the agenda, the sittings, whether the court goes to Perth on the circuit. Every year the court will go to Perth in October, to Hobart in February, Brisbane in June, and Adelaide in August. That's been that way since 1903. The dates are chosen by reference to how beautiful the weather is in the city of choice, and the court goes there for a week. Some of the justices used to hate that, but I always liked it because I always had the chance then to meet the academics and others in that city, and the students and the profession, and I think it's a good thing. The justices discuss cases, and before the case starts, they will generally have a short discussion about the case. If they've been in the special leave, they may remember 6 months earlier the discussion of the case and what the main issues in it were and why they favoured the grant of special leave, what they thought was the important point. Then they go in to hear the case. Most cases are heard in Number 2 Court in Canberra. Number 2 Court is the court for 5 justices, and most cases are heard by 5. But there is also the grand Number 1 Court, which is reserved for when the whole 7 justices sit, and that's on the ground floor, and that's really reserved for a very big case or a constitutional case. But most cases are dealt with in Number 2 Court, which I loved. I loved Number 2 Court. Number 2 Court has a big window on the side, and you can see the beautiful Australian eucalypts outside, and you feel as though you're connected with nature and with the world. In the Number 1 Court, you're sort of connected with the portraits of the first three justices and the grandeur and magnificence of it all and your supreme importance as a justice of the High Court, but it's a little bit ethereal and out of touch with ordinary things of life. But the number two court is a very good court because the barristers' podium is like that and the justices are just there, so it's eye-level contact, a very intimate place for a discussion about an interesting and important case. Immediately after the hearing of the case is over, the judges go away and go to the chambers of the senior judge or the judge who's presiding. Normally that will be the Chief Justice, but if the Chief Justice isn't presiding, it would either be Justice Gummo or me in those days. And so you'd go into the chambers of the presiding judge and talk about the case and talk about your impressions. The first part of the discussion would be your impressions of the barristers. And generally that would be denunciation and comments on incompetence and inability and lack of, he's not getting any better, he's getting worse. So be warned, I mean, that's what goes on. And then after they're through that period, they will turn to talk about the issues in the case and where their inclinations are. And ultimately, the presiding judge, usually the Chief Justice, will assign it to somebody, himself perhaps, or to one of the justices to write the first draft in the case. And to prepare the reasons for the majority in the case. So that's the procedure. And then a week after the end of a sitting, every sitting is for a month, and a week after that, in the off sitting week of the after the month, there is a video link between the chambers of the judges in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, to discuss the cases more fully and in more detail. And at that stage that the lineup is really rather clear and people know whether it's going to be unanimous, whether it's, there are going to be differences of explanation, even though there may be agreement in the outcome of the case and so on. And that's a procedure that's relatively new. It's what used to happen in the Court of Appeal of New South Wales when I was president, and Chief Justice Gleeson was party to those arrangements in the Court of Appeal, and so when he went to the High Court he introduced that system, and I think it's a very beneficial one because it helps to narrow differences and increase the possibility of a single opinion, or at least increase the clarity of the reasoning and of the differences and agreements. So that was my life. I mean, I would do this, I would go down, my partner and I, we were the best example of family values in the High Court because we would always be there. He would always come down. Most of the spouses of the High Court justices couldn't stand Canberra. And in fact, most of the justices couldn't stand Canberra. I've always attributed this to the fact that their chambers are on the top level facing west and looking at the airport in Canberra, which is where they wish they were. But we rather liked it. I mean, it's a beautiful city, and walking to the past the lake in the morning and seeing the ducks quacking and the swans and the beautiful trees and the different seasons. I mean, it's just a beautiful place. And being able to walk to work. I mean, how many people in Sydney can walk to work? Not very many. And it was wonderful. We'd also walk at night. We'd see the canopy of stars. Stars, the southern hemisphere has many more stars than the northern hemisphere. But we never see it in Sydney because of the pollution. But in Canberra, where they don't have any factories and where they don't really do any work except brain power work, you can see all the stars at night. It's a wonderful place to walk and to cogitate and reflect. And I would say to my partner, this is about the case today, and And he would say, is that what the law says? That's ridiculous, ridiculous. And that sort of made me have to think and whether that was in fact what the law said. So do I miss it? No, I don't miss it. I did it for 13 years. I did the judging in the Court of Appeal for 13 years before that, and the Law Reform Commission for 10 years before that. So I had a fair crack of the whip, and I don't really miss it. I think I had a good innings, I did my best, and now I'm doing lots of other things. But am I glad I did it? Of course I'm glad I did it. I think it was a wonderful opportunity, and I do think I wrote my decisions in a very user-friendly way. Does everyone agree with that? I mean, they are very user-friendly, because I didn't know much about the law, you see. I'm letting you into the secrets here, so I had to write it in order to explain the law to myself. And if I didn't make it clear to myself, then I wasn't really doing the job and I couldn't reach the decision. So, and I think one of my lasting contributions to the High Court were headings, subheadings, dot points, indent, space, white page, not all the crammed up, hard to digest stuff that was the traditional way of writing. And by and large, the current justices have made it a bit more user-friendly for you and practitioners to understand the court. So that's basically, that was my life. And I thought it might be of interest to you. Most of you, through fate and fortune and just life's chances, will never get to the level 9 of the High Court and will never have that opportunity. You'll have other and different opportunities. And life today for a lawyer is much more interesting and many more opportunities than there were in my day. Many more opportunities in government, in international corporations, in human rights organisations, in United Nations agencies, working in India, working in Jakarta. So there are lots of opportunities, and being a judge isn't the only one. But being a judge and being a justice of the High Court is a special privilege, and so I thought you might be interested to know all about that. And I've lifted the purple curtain. I've told, I think, two little indiscretions, but other than that, I've given you a bit of an outline of what it's like. So you can give me a big round of applause now for that. Okay. Now, questions. Are there any questions or comments? Is there anybody here who is shocked by anything that they have heard or horrified? Any comments or suggestions? Yes, Professor McHugh.
I have worked with a number of people who've met you walking to work at 4 a.m. and 5 a.m. and I wondered if you could comment on your work habits and how that has assisted you, because your career really is phenomenal and the things you get through. So you certainly...
Did my partner, Jan, put you up to this question?
No, this is... Henry Ergus told me he'd met you. Yeah.
Well, in fact, the tradition of the Sydney Bar is to start early. The tradition of the Melbourne Bar, for some reason, is different. They work till midnight. But in the Sydney Bar, generally, if you look at Wentworth Chambers, all the lights are out by about 8 o'clock, whereas in Melbourne, they're all burning right into the night. So it's just a different sequence. So I got into the habit of starting early. And 4 o'clock, it does happen, but it's not so frequent. Normally, I would get into work at a very languid hour, about 5:30 or so. It's a terrific time of the day. I mean, if you get into that cycle, there are no phone, nobody's going to phone you, nobody's going to pester you. You are feeling bright and you're feeling, you've got all your mind concentrating, which is what you've got to do in the law. It's not a job for distraction. And, you know, I do worry about the new generation with their constant need for gratification with their iPhones and having a need to see if somebody loves them and has sent them an email in the last few minutes. You really have to concentrate. So I was always an early starter, and the people I worked with, Neville Rann, before he went into politics, I did a lot of work with Neville, and that didn't do me any harm, having had this contact and getting into chambers at 5:30, making a cup of tea, sitting down and talking about the case without any interruptions and focusing. Focus, concentration, absorption, masses of detail, getting it into your brain, getting on top of it, feeling comfortable. I was always so frightened that I would look a fool or an idiot in court that I really had to get on top of it. If you're on top of the brief, you can never be made to look an idiot. You may not know the nuances of the law, but if you know the details of the facts, 90% of cases are won on facts, and therefore you can get the facts in and you can help the court with the facts. And the courts get to know who are the barristers who are on top of their brief and who are not. And if you're on top of your brief, David Jackson QC, he's a leading barrister in Sydney, he does a lot of work in the High Court, always on top of his brief. I never caught him out. In 13 years of trying desperately to ask him a question about the facts of the case, which he didn't know, never. And most of the really good ones have focused. Please remember that. If you're nervous or worried, the way to overcome that is to really be on top of the case. If you're on top of the case, then they can throw thunderbolts at you, but you'll always have a few to throw back because you will know the case better than any judge does because they haven't had the time yet to absorb it. So that's basically why I did it. I did it because the Silks liked it, and I was their slave in those days, and it meant I would feel comfortable when I stood up and could talk about the case because I knew it. Any other questions? Yes.
Were there ever any other professions that you were sort of profoundly interested in, or what was the sort of reason or inspiration that you decided to pursue law?
Well, as I so immodestly told you, I came first to the state of New South Wales in history, and I would have liked to have been a professor of history. I think that would be quite an interesting job. And then the question would be, what area of history would you take on? So I love history. Whenever I have time, sitting on a beach, which isn't all that often, but when I do, I read history books or biographies that my partner has purchased. And he's got three books waiting for me to read at the moment. One of them is Franklin and Eleanor. Franklin D. Roosevelt and Eleanor Roosevelt, amazing people. Eleanor herself was an amazing person, one of the originators of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So I'm interested in that. And another book is the life story of J. Edgar Hoover, which has been made the movie with Leonardo DiCaprio in it. And the third is called That Woman. And it's about Wallis Simpson, who was the lover and ultimately wife of King Edward VIII. So I like history. I like biography. I'm interested in that. But I'm glad I chose the law because every day in the law, at least in my law, I had a new novel. The appeal books were like a story, stories of love, of hate, of lust, of cruelty, of passion, of envy, of money, of corruption. And I never read any novels in my whole judicial life. I'd never read a novel because every day I had a new novel, which was an appeal book. And so the law, as we know, we are lucky. We live in a job which is stories, isn't it? I mean, our whole life is listening to a story, which is their potted version of the story in a case, and the solution to the story. And we have a chance to sort of play a part in that. But I think that is. I didn't want to become a doctor because I'd have to cut up rats and nasty things like that. But so that's what I would have done if I hadn't been a lawyer. Any other questions? Yes.
Is there anything about the High Court you wish you could have changed before you left?
Oh, many things. Yes, of course. I think I would have changed the system by which the justices are assigned to write the opinion of the court. In the Court of Appeal, that was done by the president, and every month I would, in advance of the hearing, assign either a single asterisk or a double asterisk to every case beside the name of one of the judges of appeal. And that meant, the single asterisk meant that that judge had to be ready to give an extemp. That is to say, had to be ready to give an oral reasons for the disposition of the case. And about a third of the cases in the Court of Appeal are dealt with that way. Of course, if the judge wasn't ready for it, it would become a reserved decision, and then that judge would be converted into a double star, and the double star was in a reserved decision, which was a big case. A judge got that obligation. But that meant that you got a fair distribution of the work of the court and of the writing of the opinions of the court. That didn't exist in the High Court. So that would have been one of the things I would have changed. But there are doubtless many others that I would have changed, but that's a status. Any other questions? Right up the back.
In the High Court, I was interested to hear.
Can't hear, I'll have to come up. Always speak up in court because most of the judges are like me, a bit deaf. Yes. Well, I have no influence whatsoever on the work engagement of the High Court now. I'm a has-been, I'm an ex. But even when I was there, most of the justices didn't agree with my approach, which was always to advertise for my associates. I had some rules. First of all, one had to be a woman and one had to be a man. Now, that's not strictly equal opportunity, because you should just really strictly take the best two. But I thought over time that would be a way of making sure that on gender I was giving equal opportunity. And I thought it was a good system, and I thought that was a real strength. Not all of the justices follow that, and not all of them over the long haul seem to have equal opportunity. But as well as that, I was keen to choose people from the non-sandstone universities. Many of the justices just chose their own old university because any university that could produce a person as wonderful as they are would naturally be a very good university. Whereas I had enough doubts about that to think, well, I'll give opportunities. Other things being equal, I chose non-sandstones. So I had the first person from Murdoch, the first person from Griffith, the first person from, I got the second. Joe Lennon, I think, was the second from UTS, and the first from Wollongong, the first from University of Western Sydney. And that was good. I mean, they were able to outrank the sandstones once they got into the environment. So what would I do? I think that was a good way of recruiting. but no one else did it that way. And it did involve extra work, because I used to advertise, so I would get something like 300 applicants, and that I had to cut down to about 50, and then I interviewed them for 5 minutes. That was then cut down to 10, and then I reduced that to 2. So it was a lot of work, but it was worth it. Equal opportunity is worth it. I mean, the old boys network and daddy, I'm not in favour of that. And it was interesting to me that in my whole time in the High Court, I was virtually the only justice whose entire schooling was in public schools. And that was, although in Australia, 67% of citizens are educated wholly in public schools. I had wonderful teachers, and wonderful, back to infant school, marvellous teachers in public education. And so I was also keen, if possible, to other things be equal, to keep an eye on that factor. Yes.
Get along, what happens in that situation?
You want to have really, you want the dirt, don't you?
Well, you're lifting the purple curtain, so I thought I'll just ask that.
Well, it's natural that because the court is dealing with some of the biggest conflicts in our country, and really hot issues and contemporary issues and constitutional questions and questions at the heart of politics, that there will be clashes. Of course there'll be clashes, and there are disagreements, and people have disagreements, but you've got to learn in professional life, you can't go on about that. You can't have no speaks. I mean, it's really just not professional. You've got to, you have your views, you have your attitudes, you express them, you write them, but you don't carry it over. There were social engagements, and about 3 times, 4 times a year we would have a dinner for somebody who we hoped and thought might be entertaining, like the British High Commissioner in Canberra or something like that. And when a justice retired, there would be a social dinner with the judges and their spouses or partners. They tended to be quite agreeable, but there weren't too many of them. I mean, you spent the whole day with this small group of people, 6 other human beings, and generally that was enough. Sir Anthony Mason once said, you should feel guilty that you don't actually love your colleagues on the High Court, because generally you had nothing to do with their appointment. And so it was that we got on quite well together. Some justices form quite close relationships. Justice Hayne and Justice Gummo are great buddies. Justice Callanan and Justice Hayden were great friends. But Justice Gaudron and I got on pretty well together. All of this is told in A.J. Brown's book on my life. The inside story, you won't get it out of my lips, but he seems to have got all the details, and you can have a look at that. So that is quite a good book. And of course, you know, there is a magnificent best-selling book by me called A Private Life. And you've got it there. I have my signing pen here. Oh, excellent. And these are selling like hotcakes. And I'm hoping that my book is going to outsell Lazarus Rising. But I think I've got a few more to sell before I do that. One or two last questions. Yes?
What advice do you have for young women today pushing for equal opportunities in law firms?
I'm sorry?
What advice do you have for young women today pushing for equal opportunities in law firms?
Well, I think, on the whole, things have definitely got better. I mean, keep in mind that when I was at law school at Sydney University back in the year 1958, there were, in a class of 110, there were five women, and one of those women was Bronwyn Bishop. Now, just because of the shift in the demography of the law schools, you're getting a shift in the personnel of the profession. And so I think the advice I would give is you just do your very best, try to get really good grades, get engaged in some activities of the university, which employers always look at. I mean, when I used to get the 300 applicants, they were all brilliant kids. I mean, most of them were really brilliant and could do the job on their ear. And then I had to have a discrimen to cut it down to 50. And to do that, I would always look at extracurriculars, see what they did, because that gave a clue as to who they are and what their personality is and what their interests in life are. And I'm sure for Justice Hayden, if you put down that you were the sort of captain of the local rugby union team, that would be a terrifically important criterion for him. Whereas for me, no, I don't think that would have mattered all that much. I'm not saying that being the captain of a rugby union team isn't a worthy enterprise or ambition in life, but it's just, but it gives you a clue, you see. It gives a clue as to what your interest's in, and especially if you've done some pro bono or extra. I always look for that. I always look for people who, and it's amazing to look at law students today in comparison to my time, how, you know, they'll take on pro bono stuff for refugee applicants. They'll be teaching English as a second language to refugee applicants' children and so on. And anybody who did that really went up in my estimation, because I thought, this is a person I can work with. This is a person who's got good ideals and is interested and is a whole person. It's not just a law money-making machine. And I think this is this is the trick in the law. You've got to become a really good expert in the black letter. Sorry, but you can't be a good lawyer. You can't be a good human rights lawyer unless you really know the techniques of lawyering. And that's what you're going to get really well drummed into you at UTS. But you've also got to have you've got to have the understanding that ours is a very peculiar profession and a very powerful profession, a profession that really influences the disposition of power in our community, because it rises up to positions of responsibility in the judiciary, in the administration, in academe, in government, in politics. And so it's got this mix. You've got to have the technique, but you've also hopefully got to have a few ideals. And if you've got that, well, you're a very sellable commodity. Well, I think you've all been very patient. This has been the inside of the High Court. I hope it's of some interest, but the better lecture on statutory interpretation is coming later. And good luck to you all in your studies, and you're very fortunate to be in such a splendid law school.
Thank you, Judge. A small token of our appreciation, a small gift.
Thank you.
But again, thank you for both being informative and very entertaining. It's always marvellous to have you here, and I hope we'll see you again very soon.
Yes, excellent. Thank you. Thank you all.